psychiatrist, primary care physician, a specialist in holistic medicine, and a specialist in infectious disease. I had a lot of stuff that had built up in my body over the years. I sometimes think that if I'd had proper treatment as a kid, I might not be disabled today. Tony submitted the paperwork in March 2016 and was notified that he was denied benefits 5 months later. About 75% of initial claims get denied nationally. He then went online and found a local attorney who specializes in disability appeals. The lawyer worked through the appeals process on Tony's behalf. 2 months later, Tony was approved and began receiving approximately $1,200 a month. After the lawyer took over, that was it. The money showed up in my account. The lawyer collected about $2,700 for handling the appeal, 25% of the disability payments that were retroactive to when Tony was deemed disabled. Tony is currently on disability, and his first review will be after 2 years. Thank God for disability. If not for disability, I would have worked myself to death and died. Tony is 42. He volunteers at a local church. I live in Western Massachusetts, which is not someplace that people think of as struggling, but it's crazy how many people come into church who are living in tents and on the street. People just do what they have to do to get by. I'm personally very glad that disability was there for Tony. For him, disability was literally a lifesaver. J.D. Vance writes of how the people in Ohio became angry that they were working hard and scraping by while others were doing nothing and living off of government checks. He cites this resentment toward government handouts as an explanation for why regions like Ohio have become more Republican. The numbers have grown to a point where more Americans are currently on disability than work in construction. In 2013, 56.5% of prime-age men 25 to 54 who were not in the workforce reported receiving disability payments. Though the numbers have stabilized as more people in this age group have moved into Social Security retirement, they are already way beyond what anyone intended. The Fund for Disability Insurance recently ran out and was combined with the Greater Social Security Fund, which is itself scheduled to run out of money in 2034. The fact that a program designed for a relatively small number of Americans has now become such a major lifeline for people and communities is part of the great displacement. We pretend that our economy is doing all right while millions of people give up and get on the draw or get on the check. It's a $143 billion per year shock absorber for the unemployed or unemployable whose ranks are growing all of the time. After one gets on disability, one enters a permanent shadow class of beneficiaries. Even if you start feeling better, you're not going to risk a lifetime of benefits for a tenuous job that could disappear at any moment. And it's likely easier to think of yourself as genuinely disabled than as someone cheating society for a monthly draw. Many Americans, disabled or not, have some degree of health problems. If you've got a good job, you might ignore your hurt back or, if your job offers health insurance, have access to an affordable way to treat it and continue working. If you don't have a job and the stress starts to mount, you can easily start to feel more infirm. This is doubly true in environments where work is mostly manual and involves a lot of wear and tear. For many, the chain of circumstances is to go from former manufacturing worker to disability recipient. The other major refuge has been retail jobs. After these jobs disappear, the ranks of the disabled will swell. Disability illustrates the challenges of mandating the government to administer such a large-scale program. It's essentially the worst of all worlds, as the truly disabled and needy may find themselves shut out by red tape, while the process rewards those who lawyer up and the lawyers themselves. It sends a pervasive message of game the system and get money, and think of yourself as incompetent and incapable of work. It's subject to fraud, and once you're on, you never leave. 14. Video games and the male meaning of life. Virtual worlds give back what has been scooped out of modern life. It gives us back community, a feeling of competence, and a sense of being an important person whom people depend on. Jonathan Gottschall. When I was 7, my parents bought me and my brother an Atari 2600, the first mass game console. The game it came with was Asteroids. We played that game an awful lot. One night, we snuck down in the middle of the night, only to discover my dad already playing. My brother and I loved going to local arcades and to try to make a few quarters last as long as possible. It was the perfect set of incentives. You win, you keep playing. You lose, you're forced to stand there and watch others play, hoping that someone is forced to leave their game in the middle so you can jump in. We became very good at video games. My favorite was Street Fighter II. I memorized the Mortal Kombat fatalities to inflict graphic harm on defeated enemies. On the PC, I was hooked the first time I played Ancient Art of War when I was 9. As I got older, real-time strategy games like Warcraft and Starcraft arrived to combine efficiently building armies and settlements with defeating live opponents. My friends and I would sit next to each other in a house with several networked computers, taking on strangers and talking trash. The amount of time I spent on video games dropped dramatically after I graduated from college. I wanted to go on dates, and playing video games wasn't helping. I developed a notion that virtual world building and real life world building were at odds with each other. I started reading books on investing and financial statement analysis, which seemed to me to be the real world analog to becoming good at video games. By the time I started dabbling in games again and asked my brother-in-law to school me in Defense of the Ancients, Dota, over the holidays, they had leapt forward to a point where I felt old and slow. Memorizing key commands seemed beyond me. That said, I still understand and appreciate video games on a visceral level. I even imagine that I could get into them again. They speak to a primal set of basic impulses, to world creating, skill building, achievement, violence, leadership, teamwork, speed, efficiency, status, decision making, and accomplishment. They fall into a whole suite of things that appeal to young men in particular. To me, the list would go something like gaming, the stock market, fantasy sports, gambling, basketball, science fiction slash geek movies, and cryptocurrencies, most of which involve a blend of numbers and optimization. It's a need for mastery, progress, competition, and risk. As of last year, 22% of men between the ages of 21 and 30 with less than a bachelor's degree reported not working at all in the previous year, up from only 9.5% in 2000. And there's evidence that video games are a big reason why. According to a recent study based on the Census Bureau's time use surveys, young men without college degrees have replaced 75% of the time they used to spend working with time on the computer, mostly playing video games. From 2004 to 2007, young, unemployed men without college degrees were spending 3.4 hours per week playing video games. By 2011 to 2014, the average time spent per week had more than doubled to 8.6 hours. The economists conducting the study, led by the University of Chicago's Eric Hurst, strained to figure out whether men who were already detached were playing video games to pass the time, or whether video games were actually causing them to drop out. Evidence pointed to the latter. Their research indicated that improved technological entertainment options, primarily video games, are responsible for between 20 and 33% of reduced work hours. The trends are different for women who have not seen the same increase in gaming at the expense of work hours and are more likely to return to school when out of work. For many men, however, games have gotten so good that they have made dropping out of work a more appealing option. "When I play a game, I know if I have a few hours, I will be rewarded," said one 22-year-old who lives with his parents in Silver Spring, Maryland. "With a job, it's always been up in the air with the amount of work I put in and the reward." Jacob Berry, a 21-year-old in Michigan, finds it easier to get excited about playing games than his part-time job making sandwiches at a local Jimmy John's, particularly given the sense of community he finds online. He plays up to 40 hours a week, the equivalent of a full-time job. How exactly are these game-playing men getting by? They live with their parents. In 2000, just 35% of lower-skilled young men lived with family. Now, more than 50% of lower-skilled young men live with their parents, and as many as 67% of those who are unemployed do so. More U.S. men aged 18 to 34 are now living with their parents than with romantic partners, according to the Pew Research Center. Video games function as extremely inexpensive entertainment on a time-use basis. After one invests in a console or computer, the marginal cost is near zero. Gamers can log hundreds or thousands of hours for the cost of one game or rental subscription. Time spent gaming is what's known in economic terms as an inferior good. The poorer you are, the more of it you consume. Recent studies found that households making between $25,000 and $35,000 a year spent 92 more minutes per week online than households making $100,000 plus a year. The image of legions of men in their parents' basements playing video games for hours on end may seem pathetic or sad, but their satisfaction level is high. Happiness has gone up for this group, says Hurst, despite the high rate of unemployment. Hurst describes his findings as staggering and observes of his own 12-year-old son, "If it were up to him, I have no doubt he would play video games 23 and a half hours per day. He told me so. If we didn't ration video games, I am not sure he would ever eat. I am positive he wouldn't shower." Video games are fun and communal. Nowadays, they're also so well designed that many almost simulate jobs if a job's progress were measured in minutes and hours instead of weeks and months. In many games, you perform a variety of mundane, repetitive tasks in order to build points or currencies or accrue items. You then use these items to make yourself more capable. You complete quests with your friends or against the computer. You experience a continuous feeling of progress and accomplishment. As one can imagine, the problems come later. Playing video games as a pseudo-job that doesn't pay can be fun, social, and even cool in your teens and 20s. By the time you're in your 30s, your friends may have moved on, and you become the loser shut-in who lurks around the local GameStop. There is some evidence that these young, lower-skilled men who are happy in their 20s become much less happy in their 30s or 40s, says Hurst. Their work skills and prospects will be limited, and competing in the workforce will be harder and harder. To the extent they ever wanted to go out and start a family, it may seem more and more unrealistic and out of reach. They are likely to stay detached and may drift from video games to gambling, drugs, and alcohol. Indeed, the most recent general social survey showed that 31% of working-age men who are out of the workforce admitted to illegal drug use in the past 12 months. The annual time use survey in 2014 indicated high levels of time spent attending gambling establishments, tobacco and drug use, listening to the radio, and arts and crafts as a hobby, with over 8 hours per day spent on socializing, relaxing, and leisure. The same surveys showed lower likelihood of volunteering or attending religious services than for men in the workforce, despite having considerably more time. Every society has a bad men problem, says Tyler Cowen, the economist and author of Average is Over. He projects a future where a relative handful of high productivity individuals create most of the value, while low-skilled people become preoccupied with cheap digital entertainment to stay happy and organize their lives. Games have come a long way since I was a kid, and they're about to take yet another leap forward. Virtual reality headsets are creating experiences that will take simulations to a whole new level. Digital entertainments will get better and better. The analog and the real world will become less and less appealing. Before long, video games, virtual reality, and pornography will merge into new forms of immersive experiences that will be more and more compelling. On a pure enjoyment basis, it's going to be hard to beat. Imagine a 21-year-old college dropout who is not excited to make sandwiches at Jimmy John's and prefers his gaming community. You could say to him, "Hey, this Jimmy John's job could go places. Sure, you make $8 an hour now, but maybe if you stick with it for a few years, you could become a manager. Eventually, you could make $35,000 or so if you really excel and are willing to work long and hard hours, including waking up at 5 a.m. to slice up tomatoes and cucumbers every morning and commit to it." The above is possibly true. Or the retail district around his Jimmy John's could shrink and a management job might never open up. Or Jimmy John's could bring in an automated system that gets rid of cashiers and front-of-house staff 2 years from now. Or his manager could just choose someone else. I can't really say that the food service job is more intellectually stimulating or social than playing video games. The main virtues seem to be that it pays money, imposes discipline, involves face-to-face contact with other real humans, and might lead somewhere. In previous eras of growth, it really might have. I sympathize with this kid in part because I feel like the trade-offs are more difficult than most people realize. If I was given the choice between a dead-end, low-end job for months on end or hanging with my friends playing video games, it would be very easy to choose the latter. The consequences are somewhat vague and down the road. Men imagine themselves to be kings, warriors, CEOs, athletes, ladies' men, geniuses, soldiers, workers, achievers, and part of a band of brothers. All of these things are possible online. Of course, I believe that people should go out into the real world, get a good job, fall in love, get married, become a homeowner, have a child, be a good parent, leave the world a better place, and so on. I've tried to do it myself. It's the substance of life and humanity. It requires a degree of evolution and positive social reinforcement, particularly trying to be a good parent. But this version of achievement is not going to be sustainable for more and more Americans. The jobs are going to lead nowhere and then disappear. There will be very limited social reinforcement. The incentives to stay immersed in the virtual world will rise as the world outside gets harder and less welcoming. Billions of dollars will be spent facilitating their immersion. A number of my guy friends have gotten divorced in their 30s and 40s. Others have become detached from society. Male dysfunction tends to take on an air of nihilism and dropping out. The world and relationships take work. You gird yourself for the workplace in a suit of armor. If you ever take it off and stop working, you get swept away. Many men have within us the man-child who's still in that basement. The fortunate among us have left him behind, but we understand his appeal all too well. He's still there waiting, ready to take over in case our lives fall apart. 15. The shape wherein / disintegration. The progress of a few fortunate decades can too easily be swept away by a few years of trouble. Ryan Avent. The challenges of job loss and technological unemployment are among the most significant faced by our society in history. They are even more daunting than any external enemy because both the enemy and the victims are hard to identify. When a few hundred workers get replaced or a plant closes, the people around them notice and the community suffers. But to the rest of us, each closing is seen as part of economic progress. The challenges are magnified because American society is not in great shape right now. There are a number of trends that are going to make managing the transition to a new economy all the more difficult. We are getting older. We don't have adequate retirement savings. We are financially insecure. We use a lot of drugs. We are not starting new businesses. We're depressed. We owe a lot of money, public and private. Our education system underperforms. Our economy is consolidating around a few mega powerful firms in our most important industries. Our media is fragmented. Our social capital is lower. We don't trust institutions anymore. This last one makes everything harder, and it reminds me of my relationship with the Knicks. I was 15 years old when I became a huge fan of the New York Knicks. I watched the Ewing-led Knicks go up 2-0 on Michael Jordan's Bulls, only to lose the series 4-2. I felt the pain alongside my friends and craved revenge. The Knicks became a part of my life's fabric with their deep playoff runs in 1994 and 1999 high-water marks. I would watch every game I could and even listen to games on the radio from my college dorm room. When I moved to New York, I stood in line each year to get nosebleed $10 and $20 seats. After the Knicks became uncompetitive, I gritted my teeth through the Isaiah Thomas era and tracked the potential of draftees like Frank Williams and Mike Sweetney. My love affair turned sour after successive years of turmoil. Not the losing. I totally don't mind rooting for a team that's developing young guys and losing competitively. But an endless series of bad behavior and bad decisions began to sour me. What started out as a wholesome sports allegiance felt more and more like an abusive relationship. I couldn't follow the Knicks anymore. Their leadership was corrupt. Their figures were unsympathetic and incompetent. I swore off the Knicks in 2014 and never looked back. That's essentially how many Americans feel about most institutions nowadays. Their love and trust have been taken for granted and abused. As you can see in the accompanying PDF, public faith in the medical system, the media, public schools, and government are all at record lows compared to past eras. We have entered an age of transparency where we can see our institutions and leaders for all of their flaws. Trust is for the gullible. Everything now will be a fight. Appealing to common interests will be all the more difficult. In the musical Hamilton, the protagonist refers to the newly formed United States as young, scrappy, and hungry. That hasn't been us for quite a while. Membership in organizations like the PTA, the Red Cross, labor unions, and recreational leagues has declined by between 25 and 50% since the 1960s. Even time spent on informal socializing and visiting is down by a similar level. Our social capital has been declining for a long time, and there is no sign of a reversal. All of these things make addressing technological unemployment harder. We no longer believe we're capable of turning things around without something dramatic changing. Among the things being questioned is our capitalist system. Among young people, polls show a very high degree of sympathy for other types of economies, in part because they've witnessed capitalism's failures and excesses these past years. I love capitalism. Anyone who has a smartphone in their pocket has to appreciate the power of markets to drive value and innovation. We all have capitalism to thank for most of what we enjoy. It has elevated the standard of living of billions of people and defined our society for the better. That said, capitalism with the assistance of technology is about to turn on normal people. Capital and efficiency will prefer robots, software, AI, and machines to people more and more. Capitalism is like our mentor and guiding light to whom we've listened for years. He helped us make great decisions for a long time, but at some point he got older, teamed up with his friend technology, and together they became more extreme. They started saying things like, "Ah, let's automate everything," and "If the market doesn't like it, get rid of it," which made reasonable people increasingly nervous. Even the most hard-nosed business person should recognize that the gains and losses from unprecedented technological advances will have dramatic sets of human winners and losers, and that the system needs to account for that in order to continue. Capitalism doesn't work that well if people don't have any money to buy things, or if communities are degenerating into scarcity, anger, and despair. The question is, what is to be done? If we do nothing, society will become dramatically bifurcated on levels we can scarcely imagine. There will be a shrinking number of affluent people in a handful of megacities and those who cut their hair and take care of their children. There will also be enormous numbers of increasingly destitute and displaced people in decaying towns around the country that the trucks drive past without stopping. Some of my friends project a violent revolution if this picture comes to pass. History would suggest that this is exactly what will happen. America has been getting less violent in most measurable ways. Violent crimes and protests are all less common than in the past, even though it doesn't seem like it. For example, there were approximately 2,500 leftist bombings in America between 1971 and 1972, which would seem unfathomable today. It's possible that we may already be too defeated and opiated by the market to mount a revolution. We might just settle for making hateful comments online and watching endless YouTube videos with only the occasional flare-up of violence amid many quiet suicides. Yet it's almost certain that increasing levels of desperation will lead to destabilization. One can imagine a single well-publicized kidnapping or random heinous act against a child of the privileged class leading to bodyguards, bulletproof cars, embedded safety chips in children, and other measures. The rich people I know tend to be somewhat paranoid about their own safety and that of their families. To me, without dramatic change, the best-case scenario is a hyper-stratified society like something out of The Hunger Games or Guatemala with an occasional mass shooting. The worst case is widespread despair, violence, and the utter collapse of our society and economy. This viewpoint may strike some as extreme. Consider, though, that trucking protests were common in the final days of the Soviet Union. A large unemployed group of working-age men is a common feature in Middle Eastern countries that experience political upheaval, and there are approximately 270 to 310 million firearms in the United States, almost one per human being. We are the most heavily armed society in the history of mankind. Disintegration is unlikely to be gentle. the unemployment rate at the height of the Great Depression was about 25%. Society experiences fractures well before all the jobs disappear. In his book Ages of Discord, the scholar Peter Turchin proposes a structural demographic theory of political instability based on societies throughout history. He suggests that there are three main preconditions to revolution. 1. Elite oversupply and disunity. 2. Popular misery based on falling living standards. And 3. A state in fiscal crisis. He uses a host of variables to measure these conditions, including real wages, marital trends, proportion of children in two-parent households, minimum wage, wealth distribution, college tuition, average height, oversupply of lawyers, political polarization, income tax on the wealthy, visits to national monuments, trust in government, and other factors. Turchin points out that societies generally experience extended periods of integration and prosperity, followed by periods of inequity, increasing misery, and political instability that lead to disintegration, and that we're in the midst of the latter. Most of the variables that he measures began trending negatively between 1965 and 1980 and are now reaching near crisis levels. By his analysis, the U.S. right now has much in common with the antebellum 1850s before the Civil War and, more surprisingly, with France on the eve of the French Revolution. He projects increased turmoil through 2020 and warns that we are rapidly approaching a historical cusp at which American society will be particularly vulnerable to violent upheaval. If there is a revolution, it is likely to be born of race and identity with automation-driven economics as the underlying force. A highly disproportionate number of the people at the top will be educated whites, Jews, and Asians. America is projected to become majority-minority by 2045. African Americans and Latinos will almost certainly make up a disproportionate number of the less privileged in the wake of automation, as they currently enjoy lower levels of wealth and education. Racial inequality will become all the more jarring as the new majority remains on the outside. Gender inequality, too, will become more stark, with women comprising the clear majority of college graduates, yet still underrepresented in many environments. Less privileged whites may be more likely to blame people of color, immigrants, or shifting cultural norms for their diminishing stature and shattered communities than they will automation and the capitalist system. Culture wars will be proxy wars for the economic backdrop. This is already happening. Alec Ross, an author and Baltimore resident, described the Freddie Gray riots in 2015 as partially a product of economic despair. The protests injured 20 police officers, resulted in 250 arrests, damaged 300 businesses, caused 150 vehicle fires and 60 structure fires, and led to the looting of 27 drugstores. While the triggering event of the riots was the death of a 25-year-old man in police custody, the protesters themselves consistently rooted their cause and rallying cry in more than police brutality. It was about the hopelessness that came from growing up poor and black in a community that had been laid to waste with the loss of Baltimore's industrial and manufacturing base and then gone ignored. Black working-class families had effectively been globalized and automated out of jobs. The Charlottesville violence in 2017 over the removal of Confederate symbols can also be seen as engendered in part by economic dislocation. The driver of the car that plowed into the crowd, killing a young woman, was from an economically depressed part of Ohio and had washed out of the military. James Hodgkinson, the liberal activist who shot 4 people and critically wounded a congressman at a softball game in 2017, was a 66-year-old unemployed house inspector from Illinois whose marriage and finances were failing. The group I worry about most is poor whites. Even now, people of color report higher levels of optimism than poor whites, despite worse economic circumstances. It's difficult to go from feeling like the pillar of one society to feeling like an afterthought or failure. There is a strong heritage of military service in many white communities that will be subverted into anti-government militias, white nationalist gangs, and bunkers in the woods. There will be more random mass shootings in the months ahead as middle-aged white men self-destruct and feel that life has no meaning. As the mindset of scarcity spreads and deepens, people's executive functioning will erode. It takes self-control to resist base impulses. Racism and misogyny will become more and more pervasive, even as they are policed in certain sectors. Contributing to the discord will be a climate that equates opposing ideas or speech to violence and hate. Righteousness can fuel abhorrent behavior, and many react with a shocking level of vitriol and contempt for conflicting viewpoints and the people who hold them. Hatred is easy, as is condemnation. Addressing the conditions that breed hatred is very hard. As more communities experience the same phenomena, the catalysts will be varied and the reactions intense. Attacking other people will be a lot easier than attacking the system. Could extreme behavior in some places even precede a political breakup of the country? One can imagine California, the most racially diverse, progressive, and wealthy state, holding a referendum to secede in response to events elsewhere in the country that are perceived as atavistic and regressive. There is already a nascent movement among technologists, libertarians, and others in California to secede on economic grounds, including the recent Yes California movement pushing CalExit and the California National Party. About one-third of Californians supported secession in a recent poll, up considerably from earlier levels. California would be the sixth largest economy in the world as a separate country. If there were a successful vote, two-thirds of Congress and three-quarters of states would be required to approve it under the Constitution, which today seems impossible. However, California's departure would permanently tilt the country's political balance, which could be appealing to the party in power. Such a vote could also prompt a reprisal or punishment. Texas, likewise, has a long history of secessionist movements. Earlier, I spoke about truck drivers who will soon start to lose their jobs or have their wages reduced as automated trucks enter the market. Let's imagine that one of them, Mike, owns a small trucking company with 10 trucks and 30 drivers. He sees his life savings about to go down the tubes because he owes the banks hundreds of thousands of dollars in loans he took out to buy his vehicles. Mike says to his guys, "Fuck this, we can't be replaced by robot trucks. Let's go to Springfield and demand our jobs back." He leads a protest in Illinois and hundreds of truckers join in, some of them bringing their vehicles and blocking roads. The police respond, but they are reluctant to use force. The crowds multiply as more drivers and rioters arrive. Inspired by what they see on social media, truckers begin to protest in other state capitals in the tens of thousands. The National Guard is activated and the president calls for calm, but disorder grows. Various anti-government militias and white nationalist groups say, "This is our chance," and arrive in each state to support the truckers. Some of them bring various weapons and violence breaks out. The protests and violence spread to the capitals of Alabama, Arkansas, Idaho, Indiana, Kentucky, Mississippi, Michigan, Ohio, and Nebraska. Locals take advantage of police preoccupation in these areas and begin looting drugstores nearby. The president calls for a return to order and says that he will meet with the truckers. However, the protests morph into many distinct conflicts with unclear demands and fragmented leadership. Mike is held up as a symbol of the working man but has no control. The riots rage for several weeks. In the aftermath, there are dozens dead, hundreds injured and arrested, and billions of dollars worth of property damage and economic harm. Images of the violence spread on the internet and are seen by millions in real time. After the riots, things continue to deteriorate. Hundreds of thousands stop paying taxes because they refuse to support a government that killed the working man. A man in a bunker, surrounded by dozens of guns, releases a video saying, "Come and get your taxes, IRS man," that goes viral. Anti-Semitic violence breaks out, targeting those who own the robots. A white nationalist party arises that openly advocates returning America to its roots and traditional gender roles and wins several state races in the South. Graffiti and literature for the new party appear on college campuses, which leads to protests and sit-ins. A shooter arrives in the lobby of a technology company in San Francisco and wounds several people. Technology companies hire security forces, but 30% of employees request to work remotely due to a sense of fear. Several tech companies move to Vancouver, citing a desire for employee safety. The California secession movement surges as state officials move to protect the border and implement checkpoints. Maybe the scenario I sketched just now seems unlikely. To me, it seems depressingly plausible. But this vision assumes that we keep the system as it is right now, where we prioritize capital efficiency above all and see people primarily as economic inputs. The market will continue to drive us in specific directions that will lead to extremes even as opportunities diminish at every turn. Forestalling automation and retaining jobs might help. Some would argue we should require that a human is in every truck, only let doctors look at radiology films, and maintain employment levels in fast food restaurants and call centers. However, it would be nearly impossible to curb automation for any prolonged period of time effectively across all industries. The result would be that certain workers in industries would be protected, while others in an industry that is less core, like retail, would be quickly displaced. This reminds me of a story the economist Milton Friedman told about visiting a Chinese worksite. He notices that there are no big tractors or pieces of equipment, only men with shovels. He asks his guide, "Where are all of the machines to dig the holes and move the earth?" His guide responds, "You don't understand. This is a program designed to create jobs." Milton thinks for a second, then asks, "So why give them shovels?" Time only flows in one direction, and progress is a good thing as long as its benefits are shared. Doing nothing leads to almost certain ruin. Trying to forestall progress is likely a doomed strategy over time. What's left? When you're left with no other options, the unthinkable becomes necessary. We must change and reformat the economy and society to progress through a massive historical shift. Much of this book has likely come across as quite negative. This transition will indeed be very difficult, but the opportunities ahead are vast. Robert Kennedy famously said that GDP does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It measures everything, in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. We have to start thinking more about what makes life worthwhile. Part 3. Solutions and Human Capitalism. 16. The Freedom Dividend. At this point, you may be hanging your head, thinking, wow, this guy's view of the future is bleak. One friend who read early pages said to me, "Reading this feels like I'm getting punched in the face repeatedly." Another said, "You should change the title to We're Fucked." There are potential solutions to these problems. Things will certainly be very difficult in the years ahead as jobs disappear. But there are things we can do that will make things dramatically better. They will require imagination, will, confidence, empathy, and a can-do spirit. Peter Fraze, author of Four Futures, points out that work encompasses three things: the means by which the economy produces goods and services, the means by which people earn income, and an activity that lends meaning or purpose to many people's lives. We should tackle these one at a time, with the easiest one first. In a future without jobs, people will need to be able to provide for themselves and their basic needs. Eventually, the government will need to intervene in order to prevent widespread squalor, despair, and violence. The sooner the government acts, the more high-functioning our society will be. The first major change would be to implement a universal basic income, UBI, which I would call the Freedom Dividend. The United States should provide an annual income of $12,000 for each American aged 18 to 64, with the amount indexed to increase with inflation. It would require a constitutional supermajority to modify or amend. The Freedom Dividend would replace the vast majority of existing welfare programs. This plan was proposed by Andy Stern, the former head of the largest labor union in the country, in his book Raising the Floor. The poverty line is currently $11,770. We would essentially be bringing all Americans to the poverty line and alleviate gross poverty. A universal basic income is a version of Social Security where all citizens receive a set amount of money per month independent of their work status or income. Everyone from a hedge fund billionaire in New York to an impoverished single mom in West Virginia would receive a monthly check of $1,000. If someone is working as a waitress or construction worker making $18,000, he or she would essentially be making $30,000. UBI eliminates the disincentive to work that most people find troubling about traditional welfare programs. If you work, you could actually start saving and get ahead. With the growing threat of automation, the concept has gained renewed attention, with trials being run in Oakland, Canada, and Finland, as well as in India and other parts of the developing world. Today, people tend to associate universal basic income with technology utopians, but a form of UBI almost became law in the United States in 1970 and 1971, passing the House of Representatives twice before stalling in the Senate. Versions of the idea have been championed by robust thinkers of every political persuasion for decades, including some of the most admired figures in American life. Here's a sampling. Thomas Paine, 1796. Out of a collected fund from landowners, there shall be paid to every person, when arrived at the age of 21 years, the sum of £15 sterling as a compensation in part for the loss of his or her natural inheritance to every person, rich or poor. Martin Luther King Jr., 1967. I am now convinced that the simplest approach will prove to be the most effective. The solution to poverty is to abolish it directly by a now widely discussed measure, the guaranteed income. Richard Nixon, August 1969. What I am proposing is that the federal government build a foundation under the income of every American family that cannot care for itself and wherever in America that family may live. Milton Friedman, 1980. We should replace the ragbag of specific welfare programs with a single comprehensive program of income supplements in cash, a negative income tax, which would do more efficiently and humanely what our present welfare system does so inefficiently and inhumanely. Bernie Sanders, May 2014. In my view, every American is entitled to at least a minimum standard of living. There are different ways to get to that goal, but that's the goal that we should strive to reach. Stephen Hawking, July 2015. Everyone can enjoy a life of luxurious leisure if the machine-produced wealth is shared, or most people can end up miserably poor if the machine owners successfully lobby against wealth redistribution. So far, the trend seems to be toward the second option, with technology driving ever-increasing inequality. Barack Obama, June 2016. The way I describe it is that because of automation, because of globalization, we're going to have to examine the social compact the same way we did early in the 19th century and then again during and after the Great Depression. The notion of a 40-hour work week, a minimum wage, child labor laws, etc., those will have to be updated for these new realities. Barack Obama, October 2016. What is indisputable is that as AI gets further incorporated and the society potentially gets wealthier, the link between production and distribution, how much you work, and how much you make gets further and further attenuated. We'll be debating unconditional free money over the next 10 or 20 years. Warren Buffett, January 2017. You have to figure out how to distribute it. People who fall by the wayside through no fault of their own as the goose lays more golden eggs should still get a chance to participate in that prosperity, and that's where government comes in. Bill Gates, January 2017. A problem of excess automation forces us to look at the individuals affected and take those extra resources and make sure they're directed to them in terms of re-education and income policies. Gates later suggested taxing robots. Elon Musk, February 2017. I think we'll wind up doing universal basic income. It's going to be necessary. There will be fewer and fewer jobs that a robot cannot do better. I want to be clear, these are not things I wish will happen. These are things I think probably will happen. Mark Zuckerberg, May 2017. We should explore universal basic income so that everyone has a cushion to try new ideas. My mom, September 2017. If you think it's a good idea, Andy, I'm sure it's a good idea. You may be thinking, this will never happen, and if it did, wouldn't it cause runaway inflation? Enable generations of wastrels? $12,000 a year is not enough to do more than scrape by. Very few people will quit their jobs because of a guaranteed income at this level, unless they were in a marginal or exploitative situation. The available data bears this out. On the other hand, the benefits would be absolutely enormous. It would be a massive stimulus to lower-cost areas. It would empower people to avoid making terrible decisions based on financial scarcity and month-to-month needs. It would be a phenomenal boon to creativity and entrepreneurship. It would enable people to more effectively transition from shrinking industries and environments to new ones. It would reduce stress, improve health, decrease crime, and strengthen relationships. It would support parents and caretakers for the work that they do, particularly mothers. It would give all citizens an honest stake in society and a sense of the future. It would restore a sense of optimism and faith in communities around the country. It would stimulate and maintain the consumer economy through the automation wave. It would maintain order and preserve our way of life through the greatest economic and social transition in history. It would make our society more equitable, fair, and just. An analysis by the Roosevelt Institute of this $12,000 per year per adult proposal found that adopting it would permanently grow the economy by 12.56 to 13.1%, or about $2.5 trillion by 2025, and it would increase the labor force by 4.5 to 4.7 million people. Putting money into people's hands and keeping it there would be a perpetual boost and support to job growth in the economy. The cost would be about an additional $1.3 trillion per year on top of existing welfare programs, most of which would be folded into the plan, as well as increased taxable revenue and cost savings. Conservatives would rejoice that the patchwork of 126 plans with perverse incentives and cumbersome bureaucracies would mostly disappear. The cost of $1.3 trillion seems like an awful lot. For reference, the federal budget is about $4 trillion and the entire U.S. economy about $19 trillion. But there are myriad ways to pay for it. The most sensible way to pay for it, in my view, would be with a value-added tax, VAT, a consumption tax that would generate income from the people and businesses that benefit from society the most. Here's the challenge. We need to extract more of the value from automation in order to pay for public goods and support displaced workers. But it turns out that automation and robots are very tricky things to identify or tax. If a CVS replaces a cashier with self-checkout and an iPad, is that considered automation? Or if a bank replaces 200 call center workers with a software program, what do they pay? Assuming appropriate staffing levels is impossible. Plus, you actually don't want to tax automation too heavily because you don't want to discourage it too much. You need the value it's creating to pay for things. Another thing to keep in mind, technology companies are excellent at avoiding taxes. Apple, for example, has $230 billion in overseas earnings it's holding abroad to avoid paying taxes. Microsoft has $124 billion and Google has $60 billion. Our current system of taxation will have a hard time harvesting the gains of automation from both the giant tech companies that will be among the biggest winners, as well as from the small tech companies, which often aren't hugely profitable. Even taxing human income will become increasingly problematic as more and more work gets done by machines and software. Hence, Gates' suggestion that we should start taxing robots. The best way to ensure public gains from the automation wave would be a VAT so that people and companies just pay the tax when they buy things or employ services. For businesses, it gets baked into the cost of production at every level. It makes it much harder for large companies, which are experts at reducing their taxes, to benefit from the American infrastructure and citizenry without paying into it. The biggest companies, like Amazon, would pay the most into the system because a VAT gets paid based on volume, not profits. It also would make it so that we'd all root for progress. The mechanic in Appalachia would feel like he's getting a stake every time someone gets rich. Out of 193 countries, 160 already have a VAT or goods and services tax, including all developed countries except the United States. The average VAT in Europe is 20%. It is well developed and its efficacy has been established. If we adopted a VAT at half the average European level, we could pay for universal basic income for all American adults. A VAT would result in slightly higher prices, but technological advancement would continue to drive down the cost of most things. And with the backdrop of a universal basic income of $12,000, the only way a VAT of 10% makes you worse off is if you consume more than $120,000 in goods and services per year, which means you're doing fine and are likely at the top of the income distribution. Businesses will benefit immensely from the fact that their customers will have more money to spend each month. Most Americans will spend the vast majority of their money locally. The hedge fund billionaire who spends $10 million a year on private jets and fancy cars will pay $1 million into the system and receive $12,000. The single mom will pay about $2,500 and receive $12,000, and will also have the peace of mind that her child will start receiving $1,000 a month when he or she graduates from high school. For people who consider this farcical, consider the bailouts that took place during the financial crisis. You may not recall that the U.S. government printed over $4 trillion in new money for its quantitative easing program following the 2008 financial collapse. This money went to the balance sheets of the banks and depressed interest rates. It punished savers and retirees. There was little to no inflation. We did this nominally so that the banks would lend money to businesses, who would then create jobs and shore up the economy. In practice, most of the money went to the balance sheets of the banks and to inflate asset bubbles all over the country, primarily in assets like real estate in Manhattan and Silicon Valley, and the stock prices of private companies like Uber and Airbnb. Many human beings did get rich from the money printing bonanza, but they were people among the best situated, not the least. We did this because we believed in institutions far more than we believe in our people. With the freedom dividend, money would be put in the hands of our citizens in a time of unprecedented economic dislocation. It would grow the consumer economy. It's a stimulus of people. The vast majority of the money would go directly into the economy each month to paying bills, feeding children, visiting loved ones, youth sports, eating at the local restaurant, piano lessons, extra tutoring help, car repairs, small businesses, housing improvements, prenatal vitamins, elder care, and so on. Most Americans are so cash-strapped that most of the money would be spent locally and quickly. The government needs to adopt, as its primary mission, managing the economic transition that automation will bring. We are way behind the curve and need to catch up. I'm relatively hopeful that the United States will wind up passing a UBI policy like the Freedom Dividend in the coming years. It's simple, it's fair, it's equitable, it's easy to understand, it benefits at least 80% of the population, and it will be necessary to maintain the fabric of society during the automation wave. It will become increasingly popular and common sense. It would simply take an act of Congress, and the checks/transfers will start going out. Labor leader Andy Stern comments, "The government is not great at many things, but it is excellent at sending large numbers of checks to large numbers of people. Even in its current debilitated state, the government could easily start collecting a VAT and sending out the freedom dividend to end poverty as we know it and prepare society for the future." To paraphrase Winston Churchill, Americans will always do the right thing after they've tried everything else. The question in my mind is what happens between now and then and how bad things will get. Believe it or not, the freedom dividend is the easy part of the transition. Money is easy. People are hard. For all of the immense good a UBI will do, it is just the first step. The ongoing challenge will be to preserve a mindset of growth, responsibility, community, humanity, family, and optimism in an era when so many bastions of the past are going to topple into obsolescence and so many ways of life will be changed irrevocably. I never played Magic the Gathering, but its creator, Richard Garfield, wrote about UBI in a way that I really liked. UBI is not shaming, everyone participates. It does not try to control the economy from the top. People can spend their money on what they want and therefore steer the economy as it has always been best steered by the consumer. It could free up the job market in ways that are hard to appreciate. I am entranced by UBI, not just as a needed fix, but as an institute that unleashes people's potential. I find myself convinced that UBI is natural and would lead to a more productive and happier world, and it would allow us to fully harness people's creativity and the technology they create. We're trying relative deprivation and it's not working. Half measures are wasting time. Scarcity will not save us. Abundance will. Before I get carried away with my argument for UBI, let's look back at the history of the concept and how versions of it are already a reality. 17. Universal basic income in the real world. It's hard to fathom now, but the idea of a guaranteed annual income was mainstream political wisdom in the United States in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Medicare and Medicaid had just been passed in 1965, and the country had an appetite for solutions for social problems. In May 1968, over 1,000 university economists signed a letter supporting a guaranteed annual income. In 1969, President Nixon proposed the Family Assistance Plan, which would provide cash benefits of about $10,000 per family and serve as a guaranteed annual income with some eligibility requirements. This bill was supported by 79% of respondents polled at the time. The Family Assistance Plan passed the House of Representatives by a wide margin, 243 to 155, but then stalled in the Senate due to, of all things, Democrats who wanted an even more robust plan. A Democratic congressman, William Ryan from New York, instead proposed an income floor equivalent to $33,000 today, and the original bill would be argued and reproposed for years thereafter. The U.S. government funded a number of studies between 1968 and 1975 to gain insight into how guaranteed income would impact individual families. The primary agenda was to see whether people would keep working if they were getting money from the government with no strings attached. The New Jersey Graduated Work Incentive Experiment gave cash payments to more than 1,300 families between 1968 and 1971 to get above the poverty line. Researchers found minimal impact on work. Men worked 1 hour less per week, while women reduced their work weeks by 5 hours. Mothers spent more time with their children, whose performance at school improved. High school graduation rates rose substantially over the period by as much as 30%. Similar studies were rolled out in North Carolina, Iowa, Indiana, Colorado, and Washington. Most of these studies showed results similar to the initial New Jersey population. However, the most rigorous and generous study in Denver and Seattle found work hour decreases of about 9% for men, 20% for wives, and 14% for single mothers. The Denver study also showed an increase in marriage dissolution, which surprised a lot of people and helped arm opponents of the legislation, who defeated it for good in 1978. In 1988, scholars at the University of Wisconsin went through the data and found that the effect on marriage was dramatically overstated based on an erroneous model. Other scholars later questioned the work decrease as based on self-reported hours, but by that time, the debate had passed. The U.S. studies involved individual families and never tried to measure communal impact. Canada tried it all in one small town. In February 1974, Canada spent the equivalent of $56 million to get everyone in the town of Dauphin, a 13,000-person town northwest of Winnipeg, above the poverty line. 1,000 families got a check each month of different amounts with no restrictions. They called it MINCOM, short for minimum income. It lasted for 4 years before a conservative government won control of the government and discontinued payments. Many years later, in 2005, Evelyn Forget, an economist at the University of Manitoba, tracked down and analyzed the results. Politically, there was a concern that if you began a guaranteed annual income, people would stop working and start having large families, recalls Forget. Instead, she found minimal effect on work. The only groups who worked substantially less were new mothers and teenagers, with the latter spending more time in school. Birth rates for women under 25 dropped. High school graduation rates went up. Perhaps most dramatically, Forget found that hospital visits went down 8.5%, with reductions in workplace injuries and emergency room visits. Domestic violence went down, as did mental illness-related appointments and treatments. Basically, life got significantly better in a town without poverty. It may be hard to believe, but one state in the United States has had something resembling a UBI for decades. In Alaska in 1976, the state started receiving billions in oil revenue from state-owned land. Governor Jay Hammond, a Republican, had an innovative plan. He pushed to place the revenue in a fund that would then pay out part of its earnings to state residents each year. He insisted that this fund had a conservative political purpose by putting a brake on government spending and distributing more of the money directly to people. The Alaska Permanent Fund accrued earnings and started paying dividends in 1982. Each Alaskan now receives a petroleum dividend of between $1,000 and $2,000 per person per year. A family of four received more than $8,000 in 2015. The dividend reduces poverty by one quarter and is one reason that Alaska has the second lowest income inequality in the country. Studies have shown that the dividend has increased average infant birth weight and helped keep rural Alaskans solvent. It has also created at least 7,000 jobs due to the increased economic activity each year. The program, now in its 36th year, despite numerous changes in government, is overwhelmingly popular. 64% of respondents even said that they would accept higher taxes, if necessary, to fund the dividend. In 1995, a group of researchers began tracking the personalities of 1,420 low-income children in North Carolina. Then, something unexpected happened. 25% of their families started receiving $4,000 per person. They were Cherokee Indians, and a casino had just been built nearby, with earnings flowing to tribal members. This development turned into a research treasure trove. It would be almost impossible to replicate this kind of longitudinal study